What should a community be? What needs and wants should it reflect in the placement of its roads, its commercial and residential districts, its services? Should it, as Lewis Mumford said, reflect and serve all the stages of life, from infancy to old age? Should it make room equally for rich and poor, for development and wilderness, aesthetics and economics? And how can a community go about doing all of that? This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, and my guest today is the president of the American Planning Association, Stuart Meck. The APA is a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit research and public interest organization. It represents about 26,000 practicing planners and others concerned with urban and rural planning and development. And Mr. Meck is also the assistant city manager and the planning director for the city of Oxford, Ohio. That city, if people are wondering, is close to both Dayton and to Cincinnati. Welcome to Conversations.
Happy to be here.
Can we begin with a couple of snapshots? I have three in mind, and maybe we can just work through them. The first is an historic perspective on planners and the role of planning in America. When did planners come to be, and what were they seen as, and how did they see themselves?
Well, city planning in the United States is really a creature of the late 19th and early 20th century. Really a creature of the governmental reform movements. City planning came about at the same time that we had the city manager form of government, the civil service movement, and also the short ballot, which was the idea of electing officials to public office who were mostly concerned with setting policy. Prior to the short ballot, of course, we had the dog catcher elected. So planning really came out of not particularly an attitude toward land or a theory about cities in the United States, as let's say in contrast to Europe, but rather as a creature of governmental reform. And the mechanisms that we have for planning in the United States are purely mechanisms of governmental reform. We had the predominant mechanism, which is, of course, is the Planning Commission, a non-elected appointive body that is advisory to the elected officials in the community and presumably is composed of the best people in the community. We also had the notion of having a comprehensive plan, which is a unified single design for the community, addressing land use and community facilities, transportation and housing. So that really was the history of planning in the United States. Many of the states, including Alaska, based their planning enabling legislation on a series of standard planning and zoning enabling acts that were developed by an advisory committee of the U.S. Department of Commerce under Herbert Hoover in the 1920s. And when planning really got going, which was really the middle of the 1920s, when the idea of zoning spread like wildfire across the United States, many of the states adopted some form or another of these standard planning and zoning enabling acts. And if you look throughout the United States, virtually all of them, even the ones that have substantially amended their legislation, base them on these standard planning and zoning enabling acts. So as a consequence, there are tremendous similarities throughout the United States in the way that planning is actually conducted in terms of procedures. Now, there are beginning to develop a lot of significant regional variations, particularly in the Southwest and Southeast and parts of the East Coast. But basically, the structure for planning is the same throughout the United States.
Was there a perspective? It seems I've read that there was a point of view that planning, the reform perspective of planning, as you've indicated, could cure social ills. If a city was well planned, you wouldn't have problems.
Right. If you look at the early plans in the United States, they mostly expressed something that's known today as environmental determinism. Environmental determinism was the belief that one's physical surroundings could shape one's personality. That if you, it was a sort of an architectonic view of the world. Architects believe that if you can manipulate and shape space, then you will affect the individual. So what happened was the early plans, and this was also, I think, reflected in the political thought, the social and political thought of the time. The early plans had lots of parkways and plazas and inspiring civic buildings Model tenements were the idea. If you provided model housing, you would get model citizens. All of these ideal, all of this ideal environment was to bring about the ideal citizen. If you look, again, if you look at an early plan, they have lots of Beaux-Arts renderings, very beautiful idealized sketches of civic buildings. To a great degree, city planning in the country was influenced by the World's Columbian Exhibition in Chicago, I think it was 1893, where, in fact, you can see the remnants of this in Chicago today, where there were the grounds of the exposition were done in this Beaux-Arts style. Many inspiring Greco-Roman buildings, statues, fountains, parks, that sort of thing. And as a consequence of that, many cities decided to emulate, at least in their civic center planning, the way the Chicago exhibition looked. And there are many cities today, like Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and Cleveland, indeed, parts of San Francisco, that have sections of town that are sort of traditional civic center planning. There was also, I think, part of this belief was that if you did planning, planning was sort of thought to be the same as efficient government. If you provided high value areas in the city, if you invested in these civic buildings, then you would produce a lot of property tax revenue, and efficient government would sort of result from all of this. So planning was allied in many cases with downtown business interests, who favored this type of civic center planning, and that's really what early city planning was about in the United States. It was really more of an urban and a local emphasis, early city planning, than it was in terms of natural resources, which perhaps it is here in Alaska, and rural environments. City planning was thought to be focused on urban problems, particularly problems in big cities. And the spread of city planning to the suburbs is something that really picked up after the end of World War II.
The second snapshot,
yeah,
is where has it come, present-day planning? Some of those ideals that,
yeah,
you've mentioned seem to carry through. Do all of them?
Well, my belief is that there is a real marked shift going on in city planning in the United States. And I like to describe this as two separate cultures, that the old culture believed in what I've just described, which is a planning commission that was insulated from the political process, that was outside the political process. The early culture believed in the separation of planning from politics, in fact, actively discouraged the involvement of elected officials in the preparation of plans. The old culture believed in a middle-class lifestyle for all. It believed that it was sort of the family of the 1950s, you know, the Leave It to Beaver,
right,
the father knows best. The old culture believed in the very, very long view. The early plans were plans that had 20 and 25 years of perspective. What I think is happening now, and it's something that perhaps is difficult to back up through survey research, because I don't think anybody's done anything, but that's why we have academics to do survey research, is what I call the new pragmatism. It's a emphasis on short-term operational effectiveness. It's an emphasis on producing results now. It's an emphasis on getting things done. It is less high-minded, perhaps, but I think it is more shaped by the political imperatives today. I think that the big difference is that in many parts of the country, elected officials have begun to see political stakes in planning decisions and are keeping the planning process closer to them. I think the mode of operation of planning departments is changing. Planners are much more concerned now, and this is pretty clear by what kinds of books they're reading and what kinds of workshops they're attending at our national conference and our regional conferences. They're interested in being better managers. They're interested in developing negotiating and compromising skills. I think that there's a recognition now that, you know, while good civic design is important, which really was the theme of early city planning, that the problems that that are facing our city are sort of messy and they're complex and they need to be brokered and negotiated, and the traditional solutions do not lend themselves well. The other thing I think that we're seeing is a change in the structure of the family, and it's not happening everywhere. But when I talk about this, I often ask people to say, you know, think about the people on your street. Are they the family of the 1950s sitcom? Is the mother staying home and, you know, making wonderful dinners and terrific pastries, or are they more likely to be single parent households, empty nesters? On the street that I live in, Oxford, we have swinging bachelors and bachelorettes. You know, I lived on one street where I think we had a household of reclusive alcoholics, gay and lesbian couples. There is just a change in the kind of the kind of thing that we're dealing with. And I think the other thing that is occurring, and perhaps it affects us nationally as well, is a change in. Again, I initially said that planning used to be addressed at urban and local problems. And I think that what's happening now is that people have recognized over the past, let's say, I'd say 20 years, at least till the end, since the end of the 60s, that land is beginning to be looked at as a resource as well as a commodity, that people recognize that, you know, we used to look at wetlands, for example, and say, you know, when I was a kid, wetland was a swamp. Mm-hmm. Now we see there a sort of a complex set of ecological relationships, and we see the value of wetlands as activities that are more than just commodities. And that's been a change. And I also think that there's been a change in the role of the state. States throughout the United States are getting much more proactive in the area of planning. It's not uniform. I mean, in Ohio, there's not a lot of emphasis, but in the area of the environment, a perfect example of the state asserting a lot of long dormant or actually never used powers.
So in that way, planners have stepped out of their refined, rarefied ivory tower and have come right down to the street.
I think the times have compelled planners to do that. One thing I think that has changed and compelled planners to do that is that there's no longer a lot of federal money available for planning. And I'd say this change began perhaps 10 to 12 years ago. And planners found that once this federal money dried up, that they had to respond to a series of local and regional and state imperatives rather than federal ones. So they had to prove themselves. They made plans that were intended to be implemented rather than plans that were intended to be, you know, attractively reproduced and bound. And that really changed things. You know, planning is much more concerned. A friend of mine used to say that a planner is somebody who sits on the edge of the bed and tells you how good it's going to be. I think that's changed.
He's in there working.
Yeah.
We're talking to Stuart Meck today. He is the president of the American Planning Association. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. The third snapshot I'm looking for from you is planners and politics. You mentioned it once, twice actually, that planners had been insulated from politics. And then you implied that the planners and politics could no longer be insulated one from the other.
Yeah.
Feels like an uneasy relationship no matter what you do.
Well, it is an uneasy relationship, and I think that... that's always going to be a problem. I still view our professionals as tending to be apolitical. I mean, perhaps they're maybe more liberal in the sense that they feel that problems can be solved through governmental intervention. But generally speaking, our members, from my experience, do not like, you know, they don't like to typically get involved in governmental campaigns. They feel that impairs their effectiveness simply because they have to work with everybody. I mean, that's their job to work with everybody.
Are their negotiating skills higher these days, their lobbying skills for their interests?
Well,
what they perceive as community interests?
I think that there is for example, in the area of one thing that we seem to have a great deal of interest in our councils, in our conferences, is land use dispute resolution. You know, working out working out deals, and I use the term deal in a positive sense rather than a negative sense, working out deals that satisfy a variety of parties. We have these sessions at our conference that are conferences that are overloaded with people trying to learn that. Why is that? Well, I think that city councils and other elected bodies that go to meeting after meeting where they have people screaming at them to do something, and there's no solution that works, are depending on their planning staffs to some degree to get various parties to a dispute together to try and work out solutions, to get people to sort of act like adults rather than children. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what people are looking for planners to do these days. I'm not saying that this is the case everywhere, but there seems to be a recognition that we can't spend, you know, our time as professionals, elected officials, and appointed officials screaming at each other because nothing will get done. And that's a problem. And I think also people are wanting to stay away to the extent that they can from litigation.
Let's move to the subject of planning.
Yeah.
Comprehensive plans from a planner's perspective are very important to a community,
right?
Yes?
Mm-hmm.
And why?
Well, I think that basically what a plan does its role is to provide the basis for a program of public investment and regulation and public action, and to make sure everybody's operating in the same set of assumptions. The role of plans, I think, has become much more significant since the Supreme Court about 3 years ago handed down a series of decisions that suggested that, basically said that there could be a monetary damages remedy for land use regulation that goes too far, that is, goes so far as to constitute a deprivation of all reasonable use of the property. They also said in another opinion that they were very much concerned with knowing the link between the regulation itself, the design of the regulation, and the advancement of what they called a significant state interest or significant state purpose. And the local governments and the state governments as well would be expected, when they advance some type of new regulation, to explain the planning basis for that decision. So plans have become much more important as, I think, a legal defense for regulation as well. And, often a good example is, I suppose, in our area of the country, I don't know if it is here, is solid waste. Our state has come in and imposed a process for the development at the county level of solid waste management plans, which, solid waste is a land use. It is a very difficult area in which you really cannot advance any solutions or propose any solutions unless you have an overall context for investment and regulation. And I suppose it gets down to the point that I think our society has reached a point where people are recognizing that the problems facing us are so complex and so hydra-headed that you really have to apply foresight to action. That is, thinking about the alternatives before you act. And that's, it's easy to say we need more planning as sort of a self-serving expression of the American Planning Association. But people are saying it, even if they're not talking about the American Planning Association. Certainly the environmental movement in the country is an expression of that. Certainly in parts of the country where people are dealing with problems of affordable housing, they're recognizing that we need to do some thinking. A lot of the concern about infrastructure in our country is a concern over the failure to plan for the replacement of that infrastructure and the maintenance of infrastructure. And it's all happening at once. It's all coming to a head. And, now that we seem to be, we're out of the mode of worrying about the Cold War and eliminating communism as our national purpose, we're more concerned with things that are happening here at home. And those are some of the elements of that.
From an academic's perspective, are there general guidelines for a comprehensive plan, whether a community has 3,000, 10,000, 250,000 people in it?
Well, I don't think you need the same kind of detail in a plan for a community of 3,000 or 4,000 that you need in a community, let's say, like San Francisco, where there may be different issues. I think that there are certain basic elements you want to have, an element that deals with the use of public and private land, which is a land use element. You want to have a section that deals with community facilities, and those community facilities may differ depending on a community. Some communities may place a premium, like mine does, on parklands. In other communities that, like perhaps this one that has lots of open space around it, neighborhood parks may not be as critical. Transportation is always an issue because you're trying to knit the highway system together. Some communities, as a transportation element, may emphasize mass transit. Other communities, Davis, California comes to mind, place a great deal of emphasis on bikeways. If you went to Europe, bikeways would be a very significant part of the transportation system. And housing. And again, the role of government and the role of private sector in the provision and maintenance of housing in part depends on the nature of the community. I think there are some general guidelines for what is important. In San Francisco and New York City, urban design is very important. In my own town, urban design is important as an outgrowth of the historic character of the community. Our community is over 200 years old.
And it's more of an aesthetic than
it's right.
In New York, it's a requirement.
Yeah,
we've got to get this organized.
Yeah, that's right.
So it works.
Yeah, in New York, urban design means thinking about the connection of the buildings to the systems of mass transit. So it's different everywhere. Some states, some state administrative agency like Florida, pretty much dictates the substantive contents of plans. Other states, they don't. So it really is, to some degree, a reflection of the state legislature's attitude toward what should be in a plan. I mean, planners believe they're, generally the four elements that I talked about. But the policy content, in large measure, is shaped by local values and priorities.
You've had a chance to look at two plans in your visit with this state, Anchorage and Fairbanks. Do you have a quick read?
I don't really have too much of a comment about the planning process. One thing that I didn't really have an image in my mind of what Alaska looked like, and one, at least visiting at this point of the year, it's a lot greener than I thought it would be, much more green. Of course, I sort of had this notion of people going from building to building, getting blown around by winter winds, even in the summer, and that hasn't been the case. It's been pretty warm.
It's a well-kept secret.
Yeah, I bought a light parka to bring, and I only got to wear it once. It's pretty sharp looking, so I'm disappointed.
But a look at plan. Can you give us a quick view of what you think when you look at these two cities? These are the two of the major cities in our state.
Well, I think that one thing that I've noticed in both of them is there are opportunities to use the rivers and the waterfronts creatively. I think that both cities that I've seen have tremendous opportunities. I've seen some use of it. In Anchorage, there are some restaurants and areas where entertainment areas along the waterfront, and I saw that here. I see some of that here. I think that's good. Some areas are taking their rivers and creating bikeways and linear parks for recreation. That's an opportunity. Beyond that, not sure I really have any strong impressions at all.
For people who've just tuned in, once again, we're talking today about community planning, and our guest is Stuart Meck. He is the president of the American Planning Association. Mr. Meck holds a BA and MA in journalism and a Master of City Planning from The Ohio State University. He also received a Master of Business Administration from Wright State University, and he is, as well as being the president of the APA, the Assistant City Manager and Planning Director of Oxford, Ohio. You're listening to Conversations. A person I spoke to recently described what she called reactive planning as like a mobile. You pull on one part of the mobile and everything else has to react. Is that how you describe it to begin? Does that make sense?
In some places, it will inevitably be reactive. Often what activates planning is a response to a perceived problem at a particular point in time. Sometimes planning can be like a card game in which people enter and exit in the middle of the deal. In that sense, it is reactive. In some places, I think people think fairly far ahead. But you're always going to be dealing, urban renewal in central cities is in essence a form of reactive planning. I think natural resources planning probably is not. I was reading, although it can be, I was reading today in the paper about, I guess there are a lot of mountain climbers at Denali, and a reaction to the number of mountain climbers trying to get up the mountain is to sort of assess the needs of mountain climbers and wonder what kinds of systems we can place into effect that will minimize environmental damage. There'll always be a reactive element to that. There's no question about it.
Let's look at something that is the downside of reactive planning. In periods of economic depression for almost any community, or when a community fears an economic downturn, let us say a commercial enterprise comes and says, I'm going to bring to you great wealth, and I am a fishing or timber or mineral industry. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps it's just a commercial venture of size coming into a community, a chain. The community that feels itself in a pinch, that feels frightened about its economic present or its economic future, may not say to that industry or that commercial venture, okay, you can build on these lots or in this area of our city or of our borough, but we need from you certain things. It may be afraid to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The two questions I want to ask you in one, and you can ask them, answer them together or all mixed up if you'd like. What are the risks of an open-armed welcome when a community feels a pinch? And what can a community, where can a community find courage to ask for certain things from a business?
Mm-hmm. Let's see, how can I respond? First of all, I want to say generally that up until maybe about 25 years ago, communities did not do economic development like they do today. They didn't have available the kinds of tools like tax abatement, tax increment financing, government loans. Those are really pretty much recent inventions. Now every state has some sort of package of incentives that they either offer directly or they enable municipalities to do. So municipalities now see their roles as where they never did before, including my own, by the way, including my own. We have a grant loan program for small businesses of providing economic assistance. I suppose where I part company is that if a community says to you that, or a business says to you, we want to come in, but we want to suspend your procedures that would, waive something that has to do with the public health and safety, like accelerating the review of building plans or ignoring things about a building or the byproducts of the industry that could hurt the community.
It may result in a substandard product.
Not so much a substandard product, but let's say contamination to the environment that actually could hurt the people's health. I have some problems with that because I think that that's a long-term issue. I don't have much problem if a community wants to, cut a deal in terms of financing. But any time you get involved in substandard infrastructure or somehow seeking significant deviations from environmental standards, then I think you're creating long-term problems for yourself. My one experience in Oxford is a number of years ago, we had a Japanese firm that we were attempting to lure into the community. It was a firm that made transmission housings for Japanese vehicles, and we went up. The Chamber of Commerce people and me and the mayor and the city manager went up and made a pitch to them, and they were very concerned about a number of things, which we tried to sort of you know, ameliorate. Water was one of them. But one thing that they wanted us to do was suspend our normal permit review processes, you know, and assure them of a fast track where we would actually be reviewing the buildings as they were being constructed rather than have the plans in the entirety. And as we left the meeting, the group that was there, including our mayor and our city manager, asked the question, if they don't want to abide by some of our basic public health and safety rules, which the building permit process was one of them, do we want them in our community? Do we want to be, the best way I can describe it is, do we want to be somebody who says yes in the first date? Or do we want to have, you know, high standards and get some respect? And that's sort of how I feel about attracting industry. I think there's nothing wrong with putting together economic development deals that, in essence, subsidize the cost of capital. That is, if you have a business that might not be, that has a that is inordinately risky, and you're trying to attract them, you subsidize the cost. But I think you draw the line when you have a business that comes in and is going to do long-term damage to the environment. If you make a deal with a business that they create a certain number of jobs, you should try and hold them to that deal. I think that's reasonable. Sometimes you might not be able to, but I don't think you should be, giving away your birthright in terms of damage to the health and safety of the people of the community. That's sort of how I think through it.
So, in some ways, the community is equally in the driver's seat with the commercial interest. The community represents its own values and priorities for its community and can say, this must be pollution-free, you must abide by these codes, and we want curbs and trees.
Curbs and trees, if that's the priority of the community. I mean, they're going to have to live with the business a long time, and I think you only really, particularly when the building's under construction, you only get one shot at it.
Yeah.
You know, there always can be, I think, variations to development standards. But when you get down to sort of basic public health and safety issues, you really have to pretty much stand firm, in my view. You can always negotiate interest rates, but I don't think you can negotiate lives.
In your view, are large developers, large commercial corporate concerns used to negotiating their future in a community in 1990?
Very much so. In fact, the larger they are, the more skilled you will find them. I recall right after I got in Oxford, and I've been in Oxford now for almost 9 years, McDonald's came in. And McDonald's is a corporation that literally is all over the world. And the people from McDonald's, and I only use this, not particular praise for McDonald's, although I eat there, but an indication of how they operate is the project manager asked to see what our zoning regulations provided, showed me the site. Then he showed me a sheaf of something like 45 site plans for McDonald's on every conceivable size and configuration of a lot. And he asked me to pick one out that I thought would fit. And first of all, I was astonished that they would have anything like this. And he said, well, you have to understand, we work in every conceivable context all over the country, and we would rather not battle you. We'd just rather you make the decision. So I picked out one site plan that I liked, maybe two, and he came back 2 weeks later with that site plan laid out on the site that he was trying to locate. You find increasingly that this is not always the case, okay, that larger entities that are used to, like people who do shopping centers and people who do large apartment developments, understand how to get their projects done and are not particularly eager to fight you. The businesses that tend to fight you tend to be ones that are marginal in nature, you know, for whom they select a marginal piece of property and they don't have a lot of time to wait you out, so they'll fight you on it. But larger interests, in my experience, now mine may be limited to working in Oxford, Ohio, and other parts of the country, larger companies don't give you a hard time.
This is Conversations. We're talking today about community planning, and the guest is Stuart Meck. You have spoken, since you've been in our community, about the taking by land use regulation. I wonder if you could just give a brief primer for people. What do you mean when you say the taking, and what does that apply to?
The taking issue refers to our federal constitutional requirement that private property cannot be taken, or the equivalent would be acquired, for public use without just compensation. That's in the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. You also have an amendment of your own state constitution, which says pretty much the same thing. It goes a little beyond the federal statute, and it says that you can't either take property or damage it. When public entities take property, traditionally what they do is either negotiate with the property owner for a price or use eminent domain proceedings. And when we speak of taking, we're talking about acquiring and possessing the property, generally, at least acquiring or possessing property for the public benefit. So parklands, roadways, public buildings.
There's an old song about a railroad running through the middle of the house.
Taking. That's a taking if the railroad has eminent domain authority.
But
recently, and this is a theory that's developed maybe over the past 20 years, there's emerged a notion of a regulatory taking. That is a land use regulation that crosses the boundary between prevention of a public harm and conferring of a public benefit. Up until about 3 or 4 years ago, a landowner who was seeking to declare that a regulation that went too far constituted a taking filed something called an inverse condemnation action. He'd go into court and say, this regulation has gone so far that it's deprived me of all reasonable use of my property. Let's say the municipality, I'm making up a case, but actually these have happened, municipality zones his property so it can only be used as a public park and he can't build a house on it. That constitutes a taking. So he files his claim, he wins, and there are two alternatives. A municipality either can repeal the offending ordinance, which was found to be unconstitutional, or it can enter into negotiations to buy the property.
In which case it could do anything it wanted with it, because it was its.
That's right. That's right. Well, in 1987, the Supreme Court handed down a series of opinions which collectively changed taking law. And the one opinion says that a case out of California says that basically you can have something known as an interim or temporary taking, in which the taking is measured from the time that the ordinance went into effect to the time that a court judges the ordinance unconstitutional as applied. And there can be now monetary damages, which is a third alternative in zoning litigation, for regulatory taking. Up until that time, there was no real monetary consequence for a regulation that went too far.
That case is a church property. They
right.
had a camp for retarded children. And
right, the handicapped children.
Handicapped. Yeah. And the state came in, was it, and said, you can't build anything on this because why?
Well, what happened was that there was actually a floodplain regulation, and the floodplain regulation extended beyond a drainage channel that ran through the center of this campsite. And the campsite, the effect of the regulation was that, at least as presented to the Supreme Court, was that they couldn't build any buildings in this floodplain area. Now, they contended that the regulation was a taking. What in fact happened is once the Supreme Court decided that you could have such thing as a interim taking with monetary damages, mm-hmm. it went back down to California Appeals Court, and they determined that as applied, or at least as the specific ordinance was constructed, there was in fact no regulatory taking, that the ordinance was a reasonable balancing between a regulatory objective and a legitimate state interest. It's very difficult to bring a taking claim. It can be done. It can be done, and a lot of communities are threatened with them. But you really have to show a court that all or virtually all reasonable use of the property is denied. Now, there is no formula right now, and there may be later in the future, where they say, well, if you cross this threshold or you cross this line, the ordinance or regulation will constitute a taking. Everything is dealt with on a case-by-case basis.
And the courts making decisions and other courts reversing those decisions shows that this is a very active discussion.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. These days.
Yeah, very hotly debated issue among planners and attorneys who do environmental and natural resources work.
An attorney friend of yours called it the...
It's the most important boring issue in planning today. I mean, you go to conferences, any place that planners gather, and somebody's going to be talking about the taking issue.
And this is a process, an argument over time that is going to resolve the power of the community relative to the power of the individual to govern his or her land. Is that accurate?
I think it has a beneficial effect, myself. I mean, the American Planning Association, of course, was not crazy about a damages remedy. They saw that as not being required by the Constitution. But I think what it's going to do is make communities more cautious about the kinds of regulations they enact. Mm-hmm. And I think to our benefit, it's going to give a better planning basis for decisions, because a court is going to look at the purpose of the regulation and the supporting documentation for the regulation, as well as the regulation itself. And I think that means we're going to get more planning to support regulations. Now, clearly, in every one of these cases, there may be, you know, there may not be good support for it. And if there's not, then the community is going to lose. But I think when a community gets sued on a taking claim and finds itself with an ambiguous situation, they'll have to make a cost-benefit analysis of whether or not the suit is worth something to them versus worth paying for, which is what they're going to have to do. If a regulatory taking is found, you'll have to pay. And quite often, municipal insurance will not cover claims like this. So it'll make, particularly in communities that sort of play fast and loose with private land, and there are a number of them, it'll make people a lot more chaste in terms of what they do.
In some ways, this next question is relative to the taking issue, and in some cases not. But there are communities in the United States, as you have indicated, that are pushing the envelope. Santa Monica is one, which has, when businesses come in, say, you not only must give up part of your land for parkland, but you must not only develop curbs and sidewalks and trees, but you also have to add in daycare centers and other things. Where's the future of a community like Santa Monica? Are they pushing the envelope so far it's going to burst?
Well, actually, what Santa Monica did, what a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of communities, but more and more communities are doing, which is something called development exactions, which is extracting concessions, not concessions, some type of a public benefit for development.
Some call it extortion.
In some cases, it may be extortion, unless there is a well-thought-out system or plan to support it. The American Planning Association enters cases as a friend of the court, and we were involved in a case in Massachusetts where we sought to actually uphold one of these, have one of these schemes upheld, where a developer of downtown property in the city of Boston was required to contribute to a fund which made provision for low and moderate income housing. Either the developer had to create low and moderate income housing, a certain percentage for every so many thousand square feet of gross leasable area of office space, or he had to contribute to a fund. Santa Monica, San Francisco, many cities are now saying that for certain types of development, or all types of development, beyond the traditional requirement of dedication of streets, that there are social needs in the city that need to be met, and when you build a new office building, which is going to require, let's say, the provision of it's going to attract people from the city, some of whom will be low and moderate income nature, you are going to have to give something back to the city. And the trick is showing the relationship between the development and the activities the development produces and the exaction. San Francisco has probably done the best job and has the most advanced program. Santa Monica was in a situation, as I recall, when they were in sort of the driver's seat. There was a bull market. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted to, you know, get land in Santa Monica without some of the controls that they put on. And there's a lot of debate about this. It might have resulted in a community that perhaps was less diverse, that older people would have been pushed out by higher rents. There would have been no low and moderate income housing of any sort in the community. It would have become a sort of a community of wealthy yuppies. And so they did what they thought that they had to do at the time. And it was very controversial. But there are a lot of other communities, particularly in California, that are doing many of the same things. It's also in part, I think, a movement that seeks to obtain some benefits out of development above and beyond taxes. You know, you might have to, if the community were have to provide the daycare center as opposed to the developer setting aside land, there would be some money. And yet, this is a way of getting daycare without expending additional tax dollars for it.
Or making sure people have a place to live.
Yeah.
It's going to be easier for a Hilton or a McDonald's or any large chain or wealthy developer to give benefits to a community that are not necessarily related to that developer's business.
Well, you have to show that. I mean, that's a base. I mean, you really, in order to uphold a regulatory system that gets exactions, you really do have to make a connection between the activity and the benefit sought. That's the trick. That's why you hire planners to figure out those schemes.
The thought was, however, that it will inevitably be easier for a Hilton by any other name than for mom and pop who want to put in their grocery store on the corner. Are there ways for a community or for a planning agency of a community to assist mom and pop, smaller businesses, to also offer these ancillary benefits to the community?
Well, again, many communities, and I think I mentioned earlier, that many communities now have economic development programs where perhaps they didn't 10 to 20 years ago. My own community, which is, I said, 18,500, has a revolving loan fund program. And we provide loans to businesses up to a certain amount, matching loans, for small business startups and expansions. These are loans which we've targeted to women and minority business enterprises because we believe that it's sort of in the public interest to diversify ownership in the community. But we ask something in return. That is, that we ask them to assure that they create a certain number of jobs within a certain period of time, and also to assure that a certain percentage of those jobs go to low and moderate income people. That is one thing that a community can do. Many communities now have revolving loan fund programs, either funded with pass-through money from the federal government through the Federal Community Development Block Grant Program, or some places have state programs, where the state is providing that kind of thing. And that's one way to do it. You have to keep the programs relatively simple. You can't treat them like you're building a Hyatt or Marriott. I mean, you really have to slim down the paperwork. But you can do it, and you can get something in return.
Once again, we are talking today with Stuart Meck. Our subject is community planning, and Mr. Meck is the president of the American Planning Association. You're listening to Conversations. Zoning has been called, in your book actually, the last bastion of the popular democracy. And a fellow named Dennis O'Hara called it the rather violent disruption of man's pseudo-sacred rights in property, a phrase which I liked. Talk to us a little bit about zoning. I should say Mr. Harrell went on to say in another passage, and this is in an introduction to a book called The Zoning Game, zoning might be likened to a great national bridge tournament with 3,000 games going on at the same time, with each foursome playing under its own set of rules. In fact, the opposing pairs at each table might use different rules. What's your view of zoning for a community, given those rather tongue-in-cheek introductions?
Well, those are actually pretty accurate descriptions of what the zoning game is about. I think that some of these decisions that I talked about earlier are imposing greater control on how the game is played. I think, for example, many communities are going to much more formal hearing procedures because one of the criticisms of zoning is the looseness of procedures. It may no longer be possible to get up and attack somebody personally in a public hearing. I think that those days are coming to an end, partly because that issue may be an issue in a taking claim. You know, if your application for some type of development gets protracted endlessly due to public hearings that never seem to end, you might have a taking claim. That may be part of it. But I think that in many parts of the United States, the zoning game is a pretty terrifying process. And I think that more needs to be done to make it a little more sensible. APA, as an organization, has been stressing the training of planning commissioners and the training of elected officials in making zoning decisions. It's interesting that we train policemen to enforce the Constitution, but we don't train planners about it, or at least we don't train planning officials about it. I think that there are correct ways of making zoning decisions. I think that there are correct ways of conducting hearings. We often place elected and appointed officials in the position of making decisions with tremendous consequences and give them no instruction or guidelines. It is not something that you can just sort of be plopped down and expect to function.
Because once again, you're talking about environmental consequences, transportation consequences, land use, residential land versus industrial versus commercial.
Right. You're asking people to go to a meeting and sort out conflicting testimony, sort out qualitative and quantitative information, ask them to weigh that against some type of policy document, and to make sense out of it. And it's not that easy. It certainly, I didn't have it when I got out of school. It took me a couple of years to develop. So we've been emphasizing the training of planning commissioners and planning officials. You can change statutes a great deal, but I think fundamentally the zoning process works best when the people in the community are well trained, the planning commission elected officials, in how to make zoning decisions. I often use this analogy that when I got out of school, there was this belief among Ohio planners in particular, where I practiced most of my career, that you could run the local land use regulation like a garage sale, sort of sloppily and with little attention to detail. You know, if somebody didn't like the price, you change the price. And I think that the whole environment in which land use regulation is occurring now has simply changed, and perhaps more rapidly in the past 10 years more than anything else. And you can no longer run your local government land use operation like a garage sale. People think you can, but that day has ended.
Do you have an image of an enlightened planning commission? Now, assuming that doesn't mean the personalities or the perspectives, people are going to come pro-development, anti-development, in between, with various investments in real estate or other interests.
Well, the ideal is a community that I think that people who are on the planning commission, regardless of what their views are, must have the ability to sort of do abstract reasoning. You know, they must have some basic analytical ability. I think they have to come to planning commission meetings at least with a pretty much open mind. I think that they have to be willing to listen to the public. I also feel that planning commissions must be trained, or at least subject themselves to training periodically, so they understand what laws they're operating on and the consequences of not following those laws. I think you have to have a chair. The chair is very important, and I think you have to have a chair that is good at extracting views out of the individuals on the Planning Commission and indeed the public, and trying to synthesize those views. I also think that the members have to be respectful of strong differences of opinion. I mean, ideally the Planning Commission should, you know, vote together most of the time, but sometimes people simply will have fundamental disagreements about goals, and they have to be willing to treat those as simple differences of opinion rather than, you know, flaws in their personal character. I think those are the basic things. Finally, I suppose, is that, and I talked about this a little earlier, is that in the early planning commissions were often composed of people who only were one interest in the community. They were they might go heavily in the emphasis of civic associations, which means there would be no developers in them. You know, they would be sort of anti-development. Or on the other hand, that they might be all real estate brokers. I think, or even in, I suppose, a third alternative is sometimes they had no people who were renters, who represent an interest in the community, or no minorities, or no women. I think that the Planning Commission really has to, you know, to provide good advice and a good sounding board to the city councils, has to be a broad cross-section of the community. And the councils as our council does, I might add, when they're filling a position, really sort of open it up to the community, not just appoint people because they worked on, you know, a given campaign or something, but to have people on the Planning Commission who are willing to work hard and really advocate the view of good planning before the council and the rest of the community. That's sort of the ideal, and that's what I think people ought to work toward.
Mr. Meck, we just have moments left, but a final question, which may be too large, but cut it any way you wish to. Lewis Mumford gave warnings about what cities were going to become, inhospitable to human beings. As I indicated in the beginning, he said that communities have to reflect the life cycle of human beings and be an aesthetic as well as an efficient and economic place for people to live. What's your view of what a city should be?
My ideal city, I'm trying to think of what my ideal city would be like. My ideal city is The Hague in Holland. It is very dense, but has lots of open space. It manages to provide mass transit, and yet it has a sort of a pleasing pedestrian environment. It's safe. You know, it's the kind of place where you take your kid in the park and not worry that he'll get sold, you know, he'll be sold drugs or something like that. That's sort of my own personal belief. I like dense cities. Lewis Mumford, I realize he was one of the leaders in our profession, but I think that history has not entirely borne him out. I think that he viewed, when he was writing his major works, he thought that cities sort of had natural limits to them, and in fact that they don't, that our great American cities are still great American cities, despite a lot of the beliefs that Mumford had that they'd fall in upon themselves.
Yeah. So your sense is liveliness, aesthetic, and
A relatively dense community. A dense community, still open space, but a relatively dense community. The opportunity for a lot of human interaction is important to me in a city. The opportunity to innovate.
I want to thank you for joining us.
Okay.
This has been Conversations. We've been talking to Stuart Meck. Once again, he is the president of the American Planning Association. He is also the assistant city manager and planning director for Oxford, Ohio. In his written works, The Land Use Law and the Zoning Digest, that is a periodical, right? And he has co-edited the book, The Planner's Guide to Land Use Law, which was published by APA Planners Press in Chicago. You've been listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you'll join me next week on Conversations when we sit down for a conversation with 50-year veteran in the world of producing, especially for radio in his first years, and then for television, Fred Friendly. He has a lot to say about television today and the future of television in our country. Join me for Conversations next week.